You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is August 3rd, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
So, Evan, what do you got for this week in terms of this day in skepticism?
It was August 6th, 1996. NASA Administrator Daniel Golden announced the discovery of evidence of a primitive life form on Mars. This evidence came from an alleged tiny fossil found on a meteorite in Antarctica, believed to have come from Mars billions of years ago. This is the famous ALH-84001 meteorite. You may remember our President Bill Clinton actually went on news that the evening of the announcement was made in order to express his thoughts and opinions on the matter.
I remember a couple things from that. I remember Steve sending an email. We have two data points.
Yeah.
And I also remember Sagan. This is, I think, soon before he died. And I remember him expressing like, oh, isn't that cool? Finally, blah, 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 like, all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, it wasn't, right? I mean, the consensus pretty much is that it was not life from Mars, and that sucks.
Yeah, there were some interesting things in there. I mean, some of the evidence was that there was carbon compounds that are usually made by microbes. There were some crystals of magnetite that are usually made by bacteria. That led to some evidence. And then there were those possible, you know, microscopic fossils. But at the end of the day, I think the conclusion is that it was all just geological stuff and nothing, not the fossils of life that we were hoping it was.
Yeah, certainly as time has passed and the newer technologies have come out, and we've learned so much more about Mars. In fact, they've got it down that they were able to pinpoint almost exactly where this rock from Mars came from.
Really?
down to a certain mountain range. Yeah, from the orbiters 2005 took measurements, and they were able to get measure the exact components in other rocks right to a specific range.
Wow. So
they're pretty darn sure about it. Now, this meteorite, from what I've read, is the only meteorite that we've collected roughly 4 billion years ago, supposedly when there was a wet Mars.
Mm-hmm.
All other things that we're comparing this to as far as other meteorites that we've gotten our hands on from Mars have not been this old. They've not come from the same era.
Right. That's right. Not all meteorites from Mars would come from an early wet Mars. They would be from, you know, over the past 4 billion years. So,
but they could still contain, you know, fossils from that period.
It's true.
Did you know that creationists had their say at the time?
Not surprised.
Concerning this particular one?
What'd they say?
So it was there's a few websites online. You can go back and read the articles and so forth. This particular one was from the Creation Ministries International, based out of Brisbane, Australia, back in 2001.
CMI.
And they were talking about they were talking about headlines erupted about this in August 1996, and gullible skeptics gloated over the supposed demise of Christianity comprising theologians bent over backwards to accommodate their Christian faith to these discoveries.
Yeah, that's what I probably would have thought at the time, I think, is, well, no God.
Yes,
inherently incompatible.
Life on Mars, no God.
They're also hoping for a very short memory because, you know, let's say we do find evidence of life on Mars or Europa or something, and it's unequivocal. It's like, absolutely. Does that mean that they're going to have to deny that then? Otherwise, it's going to call into – by the same line of reasoning, it's going to call into question their faith.
It's interesting you say that, Steve, because the last paragraph here from them reads, all the proof – and proof is like in scare quotes – presented back then has been almost universally discounted. For example, there's almost certain proof that the amino acids found in there were the result of contamination from Earth, not life from Mars. And of course, the humanist dominated media and assorted skeptics didn't give the retraction anywhere near the same publicity.
Well,
that never happens.
Yeah, that's true, but it has nothing to do with a humanist agenda. It's a sensationalist agenda.
What sells papers?
Yeah, I mean, come on.
right? So.
All right. Jay, you almost made a prediction, a celebrity death prediction. Now, in last year, Rebecca predicted the death of Michael Jackson, and that prediction came true for 2010. For 2010, you predicted the death of Amy Winehouse.
Yes, I did.
Yep. Not for 2011, but for 2010. So she survived about 7 months longer than you thought.
No, I predicted that she was going to die, and she did.
By Sylvia Brown standards, it's a home run.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, definitely.
And I think we should say that, you know, it's very sad that she died, and she's very young, and it's tragic. But also Jay is psychic, and that's amazing.
Right. Yeah, she's 27. Now, that number has some significance.
Yeah, so the thing that's interesting about it is that there are other people that died at the age of 27.
No Ooh. Kidding.
Yeah, there are actually you know, quite a few people have died at the age of 27. Yeah, by no coincidence, though, other musicians died at the age of 27. Other famous musicians died at the age of 27. So what?
I don't know. I'm pretty freaked out. Well, 27.
Maybe it's hip or something.
How many people are we talking about?
There's seven people that are on the list I'm looking at. A musician named Robert Johnson, who died on August 16th, 1938. Brian Jones.
Rolling Stones.
Who died in 1969. Jimi Hendrix. Janis Joplin. Jim Morrison. Kurt Cobain. And Amy Winehouse. Now, if you look at...
I'm sorry, was the first one 1938? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yes.
So you're talking about seven people since the 30s?
Yeah.
Well, seven somewhat famous musicians.
What does it mean?
There's
a cosmic thread.
Randomness
there.
Is clumpy.
Well, there's a few ways you can look at this. Like one of them is, okay, so they were all famous to varying degrees, but most of them were very famous musicians. Absolutely, I would say all of them had either emotional problems or had abuse problems mixed with emotional problems, like, you know, some type of substance abuse problems. So, you know, let me start with Brian Jones. Like, you know, no one knows who Robert Johnson is, and it's not interesting, of course, if you don't know who he is. But Brian Jones was a member of the Rolling Stones, and he died by misadventure or drowning, most likely because he was on drugs or drinking. Jimi Hendrix, he basically died of asphyxiation because he threw up and he inhaled his own puke because he was drunk or on drugs. Janis Joplin, probable heroin overdose. Jim Morrison, heart failure, although there wasn't an autopsy, but he had heart failure. It was speculated because of drug abuse.
He's still alive.
Well, if he is, he definitely is portraying Santa Claus, because if you see an age
Jim
photo
Morrison,
of him,
he's lurking around Paris working as a no-name poet. Everybody knows that. It's a fact.
Kurt Cobain,
anyway, go on.
His name?
Capped himself, and you know, I've never heard anybody say that he was on any kind of hardcore drugs, although, you know, in this circumstance, I wouldn't be that surprised, but I definitely know that he was suffering from depression. And then Amy Winehouse, they think the current speculation is that she was suffering from alcohol withdrawal, and that could have given her a heart attack or something.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What is she? Mm-hmm. What is she? True? Bender? She needs alcohol to live?
Well, alcohol withdrawal is a very medically dangerous withdrawal. It's like more dangerous than withdrawing from heroin.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, yeah.
What's going on in the body when that happens?
Oh,
when
you get like this massive sympathetic response, your blood, you get incredibly dehydrated, your blood pressure drops out. You know, you will likely die if you detox from alcohol, like without medical attention. It's a high risk situation for death. Yeah.
How much alcohol are we talking about? Like, how much do you have to have been consuming? I mean, should I go have a beer right now just in case? that's what I'm asking.
To Rebecca.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you mean,
just to be safe.
You have to basically be addicted, you know. Yeah, it's like the people who are alcoholics who drink daily who go through the DTs, you know, when they stop drinking.
Right.
Maybe what Rebecca's asking, and is there like a liver? Is there a level in your liver you can measure, right? Or is it just...
We go by the alcohol level, the blood level. And it actually depends.
So it is blood level.
Yeah,
okay.
It depends. I've seen people get withdrawal symptoms from alcohol at blood levels that would make the average person drunk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they're just massively tolerant. Yeah, so it just depends. So I found a website. It's actually a religious website preaching about how the wicked will die young. And it's premature death of rock stars, though. And it's just a nicely compiled list of rock stars and their age at death and how they died. And there's, you know, it's a long list with ages scattered in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. And you could find clumps. You could have a 51 club if you want or whatever. Just pick a number and you could find probably 5 or 6 or 7 rock stars mm-hmm. that died at that age. So there's nothing special about 27, except maybe it's a little bit of just a random clumpiness there.
And it's confirmation bias. Every time it happens, people will promote it more.
Remember it.
Yeah, remember it.
Well, part of it, too, is that, you know, the bulk of the people here were thought to be, you know, very talented, very poetic. A lot of things that I've read about this, like these people were viewed as being entrepreneurs of music, you know, like people that broke new ground and all that stuff. But if you think about it, you know, we're really talking about 6 people. I would say that if you were and if you just take Kurt Cobain off of there because he killed himself, most of them died from some type of substance abuse situation. And, you know, if you're going for broke as a rock star, you know, what are you going to make it to your late 20s, early 30s? You know, it's not unlikely that if you're really going for it, that you're going to do yourself in by the time you get into your late 20s.
It's a lifestyle that celebrates dying young, so it's not surprising.
Yeah. Well, certainly the cliche rock and roll lifestyle is not amenable to a longevity.
And what's the alternative here? I mean, are we to believe that there is some type of curse on talented, famous people, or that, you know, maybe they all sold their soul to the devil or some stupid thing like that? Like, you know, the bottom line is a lot of people die. A lot of people die young when they abuse themselves, and it is just a coincidence that 27 happens to be the ages that these people died at.
Although I've heard some speculate that now that you have this legend of the 27 Club, that it may actually act as a trigger. You know, so if you are a troubled, suicidal rock star, you may decide, hey, if I kill myself at 27, I'll be immortalized in the 27 club.
It's true.
So it becomes a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I don't know that that's actually happened, but
there is evidence to show that suicides, like a news coverage of suicides leads to copycat suicides.
Yeah.
So I don't think that – I think this is sort of related. You know,
right?
Well,
didn't we just recently cover suicides in this particular location in Japan? Was it some forest, some suicide forest that seemed to be increasing, and it's because of this allure of, you know, joining that club of people that have committed suicide in a specific way, or in this case, at a specific birthday.
But the bottom line is now both Jay and Rebecca have a celebrity death prediction under their belt.
It's true. It's true.
The rest of us are not so good. We have some catching up to do.
Yeah, good luck, guys.
Yeah, right. Good luck for us. Bad luck for them.
You know what's funny, though? I think Rebecca and I did the same thing that the psychics do. Like, Rebecca picked Michael Jackson because the guy, you know, definitely was living a very unhealthy life. I mean, maybe, of course, there was some luck involved, but, you know, did you give it much thought before you picked, or did you just say, I think I'll just pick Michael Jackson at random?
Well, yeah, I mean, I picked someone who was sort of spinning out of control.
Yeah.
And you're right, I think that is what psychics do.
It's a high probability hit, let's face it.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, Jackson, I don't really?
But that's what psychics do. You know, they throw in the bulk of their predictions are gimmies. You know, there's going to be an earthquake in California type predictions.
Right.
But then they throw in a few of these wild guesses because if those wild guesses fail, everybody forgets about them. But when the wild guesses hit, then boom, that's money.
Exactly.
So it's a wild guess, but it is one still based on probabilities, you know.
Yeah,
it's a low risk gamble with a high reward if it pays off.
Yeah.
this is all in fun, and you know, we're not trying to be too morbid here, but the whole point of it is to show anyone could be a psychic. You know, we're just doing the same thing they are, and our predictions are turning out pretty well too. It's the whole point. It doesn't take much to get lucky, and with just really just a very few predictions. Now imagine if we were tossing out hundreds of predictions.
Yeah,
and also
we'd be rich.
It's important to think about the fact that there's a lot of second-class psychics under the surface, you know, under the radar, and making lots of predictions, and then of course the one that hits then makes the news, but we don't hear about the hundreds of psychics who made predictions that didn't come true.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. Rebecca, you're going to tell us why a lake in Texas is turning blood red. Is it a sign of the end times? That's what all of the reporters want to know.
Well, yeah, that was going to be my answer. Why is a lake turning blood red? Because it's the apocalypse. Way to give away the ending.
Sorry,
Steve.
Sorry,
thanks.
Rebecca.
Thanks.
Just hate when you
do
that.
It's true. A lake in Texas has turned blood red, and there are people who are claiming it's the apocalypse. Why not?
Believed by some to be the apocalypse.
They're selling t-shirts that say, "It's the apocalypse, stupid."
Uh-huh. Ooh, there is, in fact, a really hilarious preacher named Paul Begley on YouTube, who is this, just old school crazy preacher.
Now, hey, wait a minute. They don't let anybody on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
And not anybody can be a preacher.
It's tough to get in these days. But yeah, it is just an insane person in front of a green screen ranting about how this proves the Bible correct, because apparently in the Bible it says that the end times will be marked by the seas, the waters turning blood red. So here we have this happening in, of all places, Texas, because we know how unchristian Texas is. You know, where else would it be? So is that happening? Well, you know, if you talk to, I don't know, actual scientists or people who work with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, it's actually just because of the drought. What's happening is there's a West Texas is experiencing an extreme drought right now, and this lake that was once a very popular fishing spot has now dried up, and it's now just a tiny pond, basically, with tons of dead fish floating in it. And apparently there's a bacteria which thrives in oxygen-deprived water. So when the water gets really low and all of the wildlife starts dying, this bacteria flourishes and turns the look of the water red. Of course, that is, you know, if you are an evidence or reality-based person. But if you're not, then you can feel free to believe that this marks the end times because someone wrote about it long ago. Oh, you know, and again, if you're a reality-based sort of person, you might guess that people long ago may have been experiencing droughts, which may have taken their stock of food away, which would be very damaging to their culture, to their communities. And then the water turns red, and so they might write about that as though it is the end times, because people are starving, and the water is blood red, and they don't know why, and it's scary. So
yeah, that would be pretty scary to a primitive society, you know.
Come on, you're reaching.
I'm just taking a guess here and saying maybe that's why people see blood red water as a sign of the end times.
This is yet another example, though, of like using really loose criteria to match your prophecy or your predictions. You know, they're quoting Bible passages that apparently say the seas would turn red, and he said, "Yes, right. Seas, one lake in Texas,
a pond, whatever,
yeah, a pond. Yeah. That's good enough,
pool,
yeah, good enough."
I do suspect, though, that this sort of thing is, I mean, you know, seas can turn red as well, I think, because of bacteria and algae. So, you know, I think people long ago saw natural occurrences happening and wrote about them, and that's what's been passed along.
Yeah.
And the nice thing is that we don't live in a time like that anymore. We live in a time when we actually know what bacteria are, and we know why water turns red. So.
Yeah, but the preacher on YouTube.
Yeah, I know. It's a very convincing YouTube video.
Well, let's go on to Trojan asteroids. Evan, do you know what a Trojan asteroid is?
what kind of response is that?
I didn't expect that Steve was going to answer the question.
I want to make sure you're paying attention. You know, I always single out individual students when I'm talking, lecturing, to make sure that they're awake.
Now, I know what a Trojan is, and I know what an asteroid is, so I must know what a Trojan asteroid is.
A Trojan asteroid is one that that's in the same orbit as a planet or moon, but does not intersect that body, that planet. And that's because it's orbiting around one of the Lagrangian points. So there are a number of these asteroids have been discovered for most of the gas giants like Neptune and Saturn and Jupiter and also Mars. So essentially, if you imagine the orbit of a planet around the sun, leading that in that orbit by 60 degrees and trailing by 60 degrees are two of the five Lagrangian points. These are like stable points in the gravitational field between the planet and the sun. So that it's actually like a little gravitational sinkhole, and things can get stuck there, or they could orbit around it. Again, remember we've talked before about that old graphic imagery of gravity, where you have like a bowling ball on a trampoline, and it causes a dimple.
Yeah.
Or that's actually, although it's a two-dimensional representation of what we're talking about three-dimensionally, it's actually can help you visualize this if you then like imagine a bowling ball sinking really deep in. And trampoline, then you take another, like a marble, and it would revolve around that the bowling ball.
That groove that leaves in space.
Right. So the Lagrangian points are like that. They're these little sinkholes in gravity that things can either get stuck into or revolve around. So the thing that's happened recently is that astronomers have discovered the first Trojan asteroid of Earth. So we knew that these things theoretically probably existed, but we just had never detected one before.
So this asteroid is living in the in that little warping of space that the Earth leaves.
Yes, it's in the leading or the L4 Lagrangian point. So it's like ahead of Earth in its orbit. But the asteroid's orbiting around the sun. It's just linked to the orbit of the Earth because of this gravitational sinkwell, the Lagrangian point. Its orbit is really neat. I mean, we'll have the link and you can take a look at it. It's actually, if you can imagine a plate facing the sun, and you place that in Earth's orbit ahead of the Earth, and then the asteroid is orbiting around the rim of that plate. So the asteroid's orbit actually takes it pretty far out of the plane of the solar system, or out of the plane of Earth's orbit around the sun, both above and below. And it's sort of corkscrewing its way around the sun, leading the Earth as it goes around the sun. It's really cool. The NASA made some animations, you could see the orbit.
From what perspective is the orbit?
Yeah, so if you're like outside the orbit of the Earth looking in at the Earth and the sun, and then the asteroids off to the right, sort of corkscrewing around that Lagrangian point. The asteroid is only 1,000 feet in diameter, so it's pretty small. It's about 50 to 80 million kilometers away from the Earth. Astronomers say that they've calculated its orbit, and it's a pretty stable orbit. It'll be stable for at least 10,000 years.
Wow. Do they know how long it's been?
They don't know how long it's been there.
Steve, does it mean that it actually crisscrosses a place in space that Earth passes through?
Yeah, yeah. But it will not. It will never hit the Earth because it's staying. It's keeping its distance, unless its orbit becomes unstable for some reason. But at least for 10,000 years, it's going to be in that orbit.
All right. So to visualize it, because I'm not quite getting the Lagrangian situation here. If you picture the sun and then you picture the Earth going around the sun, let's say like the Earth is going around the sun in a typical way, like on a plane, that you can visualize, right?
The Lagrangian point itself is on the orbit of the Earth around the sun. It's 60 degrees, you know, it's like a 60-degree arc of that circle of the Earth's orbit on both sides of the Earth, both in front of and behind. There are two different Lagrangian points. There's also one, there's three other ones that, you know, with other relationships to the orbit. But those are the two that have the Trojan satellites. Typically, asteroids will orbit around that point. You know, it's possible that it could be at rest with respect to that point, but typically they have some, you know, momentum with relation to that point. So that they can orbit around it as if it, they were orbiting around a body, right? Like a moon or a planet. It is a gravitational well, just like a moon or a planetoid or a planet makes a gravitational well. And this one happens to be orbiting vertically with respect, you know, like almost perpendicular with respect to the orbit of the Earth around the sun. So it's going above and then below the plane of the Earth's orbit.
Okay.
Was there any reason to believe that this only happened with larger outer planets as opposed to the
smaller? Well, they have more gravity, so they have bigger gravity wells. And also because of the location with respect to the asteroid belt. So Jupiter has tons of Trojan asteroids in both points of its orbit, probably because it's, you know, getting them from the asteroid belt.
But does the Lagrangian points always imply in relation to the parent star? I mean, not necessarily, right? It could be two other bodies. It could be a planet. It could be a moon and
it could be a moon and a planet. Yeah,
moon and a planet. And so, is that the case for Jupiter and Saturn? Because I would think, since I mean, Jupiter is huge, but it's also incredibly much farther from the sun. So I wonder how that would impact its Lagrangian point.
Yeah, well, it's pretty big though. I mean, the Jupiter Sun system has, you know, pretty high gravity at their Lagrangian points, and there's lots of asteroids revolving about them. And in fact, astronomers have discovered, one of the moons of Saturn has a Trojan asteroid for itself. Yeah,
oh,
so
cool.
We have discovered Trojans of moons in the solar
cool.
system. But this is the first one for Earth. Now, the notion came up of whether or not this would be a good destination for
sure.
a visit, but unfortunately, it wouldn't be.
Really?
Because
it's not big enough, right?
No. The main problem is that because it spends most of its time outside of the plane of the solar system, it would cost a lot of energy to get there. Lot of energy.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So it would not be a practical place to try to get to. Now, if there was one that was hugging within the plane of the solar system, that would be better. That would be a low-energy object to get to from the Earth. This would be a very high-energy object to get to.
Well, couldn't they just time it so that it intersected the asteroid when the asteroid intersected our orbit?
I guess if they just wanted to do a flyby, but if you want to actually follow the thing, get in orbit with it, then you'd have to, you know, get all that momentum out. It's completely
right.
outside the plane of the momentum that we already have from the Earth going around the sun.
So this asteroid was discovered in 2010, but they only realizing recently that that's a Trojan asteroid.
Yes, it's 2010 TK7. But yeah, it took time to confirm its orbit and everything. Yeah, that's right.
Cool.
Yep, that was pretty cool. All right, well, Bob, tell us about the radioactive decay and its effect on the temperature of the Earth.
If you insist. Scientists have determined that more than half of the heat emanating from the Earth comes from the production of neutrinos caused, like Steve said, by radioactive decay. Now most headlines for stories on this news item sound pretty much similar to what I just said, but the other perhaps more interesting aspect of this discovery, I think, is that a new and perhaps revolutionary new tool for investigating the interior of the Earth is what allowed this discovery to happen in the first place. Now, if you want to read about this, this is going to be published in the July issue of Nature Geoscience. And what first struck me about this was the bit about neutrinos. They, you know, I've always thought of them as pretty much coming from the sun or from cosmic ray interactions. But actually, radioactive elements in the Earth also produce them. I mean, they're not strictly neutrinos, they're antineutrinos, or geoneutrinos is how they're generally referred to. Now, we've talked about neutrinos plenty of times. They're just those cool little buggers. They're elementary particles with no charge. They don't interact with normal matter. People often say that neutrinos can go through light years of lead without interacting with any of the matter. And so, but, and that's, it's true. I mean, they're affected only by gravity in the weak force. So they're very,
they interact very, extremely weakly with regular matter. I wouldn't say not at all.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it would go through light, literally light years of lead before it could actually interact. But yeah, when you have a lot of them, but the odds will tell you that some of them are going to interact. Like, for example, there's so many of these guys being produced by the sun. If you guys hold your palm out in the sun's direction for 1 second, about 100 billion neutrinos just went through your hand. So by the sheer numbers, you're going to get some that interact.
Neutrinos are the reason why everything went, wrong in The Day After Tomorrow.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is it the day? No, what was the most recent one?
That was,
not The Day After Tomorrow, but the 2012.
2012, yeah.
Tomorrow was yesterday?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
special effects extravaganza.
it was because neutrinos suddenly started interacting with matter in the Earth's core, I think.
Punching holes, right? Like Swiss
cheese.
Oh,
is that why they had to drill down there and get in there and see what the hell's going on?
Yeah.
That's a different movie. They didn't actually go in. That's The Core.
That's The Core.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
Which is another terrible movie.
I hate it when the laws of physics arbitrarily change like that.
I know. Right. It's very, yeah, it doesn't result well for humanity.
It's interesting though, in light of this discovery, that 2012 though, because it actually is the processes that create the neutrinos that are actually cause more than half the Earth's heat. But they used the Camland neutrino detector in Japan to actually do these experiments, and they were able to detect antineutrinos created from the radioactive decay of elements like thorium and uranium. And this is then allows us to get an idea of actually how much thorium and uranium there is in the Earth, which we weren't really able to do before. We knew previously that Earth produces about 44 terawatts of heat energy, 44 trillion watts. I'm not sure where they stuck the thermometer to get that reading, but man, that's a lot of heat energy. But now using this method, we now know that 25 terawatts out of the 44 or more than half comes from the radioactive decay of these isotopes, which also, of course, creates the antineutrinos. A lot of people are calling this, revolutionary. We can't travel to the center of the Earth like Jules Verne's novel and movies and physically see, you know, what's there.
Oh. Or in the core.
Like, right, like dinosaurs and Atlantis, right? It was Atlantis that they found in the movie. Wasn't that they found the remains of the city? But up until now.
I don't know. I saved my money.
No, that was, oh God, come on. I grew up watching
Not
that movie.
Core.
That movie was awesome.
Oh, that one?
No, I'm talking about the Jules.
Too.
Bob, if the Earth stopped spinning, what would happen?
The Earth stopped spinning.
That would be really.
Is that what happened
how
in the
abruptly,
core? I think that's
well,
what
core,
happened. In
the core of the Earth. Yeah, if the core of the Earth stops.
No,
spinning.
No. If the actual Earth stopped spinning, what would happen?
Well, half of it would melt and the other half would freeze.
Yeah, it would
and
be
all
disastrous.
The continents would move.
The first. Gravity you know what? One effect. Of the first indicators, I think, would be GPS. GPS would get all sorts of screwed up. But it would cause you incredibly think? Intense weather problems and we'd have. It would probably kill almost everybody. There'd only be certain areas. On the Earth where that would be fairly livable. But, yeah, it would be really bad. But don't worry about that.
Are we talking a shrieking stop or a gradual
yeah, right.
slowdown?
Yeah, I'm thinking right. gradual slowdown.
Like
but
you hope.
But so up until now, we couldn't get inside the Earth, but we were able to look at what was going on inside the Earth, and that was using seismology, basically just analyzing vibrations as they propagate through the rock and the mantle and the magma of the Earth. Seismology is good and all, but it only tells us where the boundaries of the different types of rock are. So a century after Jules Verne's journey to the center of the Earth, we really still only had this one method for checking out what was inside the Earth. But so now we've got a completely new way to look at the Earth, giving us completely different information. And that's the beauty of this discovery, I think. It's a completely new tool letting us essentially, you know, it's doubling the number of ways we can to investigate Earth's interior. It's a completely new way to find out what's going on inside there. And I hope that this new window into the Earth will let us to better model the interior of the Earth. And it could also help us model the magnetic field, which could be pretty beneficial. So who knows what we may find with this new view, but I can guarantee that I won't be dinosaurs in Atlantis.
Are you guys aware that this is a source of debate with creationists also? This is yet another issue that they bring.
Of course it is.
Why?
Anti-neutrino production?
They always stick their nose in.
No, the effect of nuclear reactions or nuclear decay on the temperature of the Earth. So you guys remember Lord Kelvin?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yes. That was, that's yeah, a great story.
Good, yeah, yeah, yeah. He calculated the maximum age of the Earth to be about 100 million years based upon the temperature of the Earth. You know, if you figure at some point the Earth is molten and now it has a certain temperature. You know, it would have taken no more than 100 million years for the Earth to cool all to right. its current state.
So how could evolution happen?
Yeah, that's like a single stroke. Evolution could not happen because the Earth is not old enough. However,
but he hedges. But didn't he have a qualification though? Unless there's some new process we're not aware of.
Yes, then radioactivity
is what a proper scientist does.
Exactly what it is.
It's a trap.
Yeah. So that, but then of course those calculations were made obsolete by the discovery of radioactivity, and this is just more extending that evidence that radioactive decay accounts for more than half of the heat of the Earth, but it also kept dramatically slowed down the cooling of the Earth. Is compatible with the Earth being 4.5 billion years old. So I went to Answers in Genesis because I was looking for answers. And they,
why'd you go there then?
They have an article from April of 1999, arguing that this whole notion of radioactivity warming up the Earth is just a whole bunch of a lot of guesswork. So they do what they typically do.
All science is guesswork. Everything
they say, and the number's actually not that different than what they are now. So I guess this is really confirming some numbers that we already knew. They said that. Heat flow from the Earth's interior is 4 × 10^13 watts, and then the heat from radioactive decay is 2.4 × 10^13 watts. And so why aren't the numbers exactly the same? So then they say, well, because those numbers aren't exactly the same, those scientists don't know what they're talking about, and they don't know where the extra heat is coming from, and therefore it's all BS, right? But what they don't do is calculate how old the Earth would be if there weren't, and of course there are other sources of heat, right? The radioactive decay isn't the only source of heat in the Earth's crust. There's other sources as well.
Well, yeah, primarily though, it's a general, just the general cooling from the primordial Earth. That's still there. The heat is still being created from that. So it's still cooling off. So that's the other part of
it. That's part of it. There's also tidal forces and there's other things as well.
I wonder how much heat that produces.
Yeah, there's phase transformations from the mantle to the core. Whatever. There's other things that geologists.
Yeah.
But yeah, of course, it's all speculative. I mean, some are pretty well established, but others are fairly speculative. But the fact that we don't know exactly the source of every watt of heat of the Earth, they use that to say that therefore the Earth could be 6,000 years old.
Heat of the
gaps.
That's
the same thing they do with evolution. We don't know the exact mechanism of how this evolved into that. Therefore, we're just guessing.
It's what they do with everything. It's what they do with radioactive radiocarbon dating or just radio dating. It's like, oh, the dates don't match up exactly. They say this method says it's 3.8 billion years and that method says 4.1 billion years. Therefore, it's 6,000 years. No,
And then they conveniently ignore the preponderance of evidence that all of this has together.
Right. That's a key thing.
Amazing short-sightedness.
Right. But we'll see if they update their article on Answers in Genesis with this new data.
Remember, we're the humanist-driven media.
That's
here.
That's true.
So. That's what you're listening to right now.
All right. Well, let's go on to Who's That Noisy?
It sure is, Steve. But before we get to Who's That Noisy, we review last week's noisy and the answer and the winner. A little bit of house detail to do, housework. Back from episode 311, Who's That Noisy was submitted by Ashley Zinnick. So thank you again. That was the screw being dropped down the jet plane engine. Made that nice little xylophone-ish sound. Mm-hmm. And back from episode 312, we played the winning clip, but we didn't announce the winner. And the winner was Belgarath from the message boards, from the forums.
Yay. A frequent flyer.
Yep. And that was the Louis Theroux clip, which was submitted by Tony Grant. So well done, Belgarath, and thank you, Tony, for supplying that to us.
We caught up?
Pretty much, yes.
Okay, so what was last week?
Last week's Who's That Noisy? Here we go.
Take a pinch and a little bit of wine.
Well, I'll try it right now.
Oh, good heavens. No, you must do nothing of the kind. You see, this is a homeopathic medicine. If you take it without having a headache, it may do you no end of harm. Wait till you have one and then try it. You will be astonished at the result.
That was one of the more cogent arguments I've ever heard for a homeopathic remedy, I think.
So was that clip like 80 years old?
Not quite 80 years old. That clip from 1976. At least that's when it originally aired, March 29th, 1976, from CBS Radio Mystery Theater. And the series, it was entitled The Saxon Curse, episode number 457, to be specific. Thank you to David Simon for supplying us with that noisy. We did have a winner.
I figured.
Yep. A. Zinnick from the message boards was the first one to guess correctly. Although he found the quote. Now, he found it from Oscar Wilde's short story, Lord Arthur Saville's Crime. And it was, and he actually shared the clip he got it from, which was even older than 1976. It had to be 40s or 50s. So,
yeah, that's what it sounds like.
The Saxon Curse may have been just a more modern take on the old story, which is what I think it is, because it's apparently been recorded several different times. And
all right, what do you got for this week?
All right, here is this week's Who's That Noisy? Right.
That's a tough one. Not going to get that one with Google.
Give us your best guess, folks. info@theskepticsguide.org or on our forums at also at theskepticsguide.org. Good luck, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan. I think we have time for one email. This one comes from Adrian Robinson from Hungerford, UK. And Adrian writes, "Hi, gang. I've just finished watching a talk on TED by Breen Brown on the power of vulnerability. In her talk, she quotes her old research professor, 'If you can't measure it, it does not exist.' I heard the quote and immediately wondered what reaction a panel of skeptics might have to such a statement. Bypassing the obvious 'how do you measure love' and so forth, is the statement valid or is it a little more than a catchy soundbite?" What do you guys think about that? If you can't measure it, it doesn't exist.
Well, not a that kind of implies like a you need a direct measurement, some sort of meter that will read this stuff out. But I mean, you can infer lots of things without directly detecting it. Like for love, which is pretty much what the canonical example, right? You can't measure love, but I mean, but you can infer state, you know, that state by measuring, you know, the different states of the brain and things like that. So
yeah, you can measure the amount of hormones being released and things like that. As much
right.
as people don't like to think of our emotional states as being controlled by our physical bodies, they are.
Right.
And
what else would
I think
control
that's just it. Like, yeah, everything we experience has some physical cause that can, in fact, be measured.
But my take on this, I agree with everything you guys are saying. My take on this also was that it is a little bit of hyperbole, and what the professor meant was that if you can't measure it, it does not exist to science. Not that it doesn't really exist. It's just not something that is usable by science, right? I think that's probably what the professor meant.
You know what I thought when I read this, Steve? If a tree falls in the woods, no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound?
Well, that's different. That's a little bit different. That's based upon how do you define sound. If
exactly,
sound
right.
is the interaction of, if sound is just the vibration of air, then yes, it does. But if it's the interaction with that with a auditory system, then no, there's got to be an auditory system to transfer the vibrations into sound.
But Steve makes an awful Buddhist.
But what he's saying, what the professor is saying, is an important aspect of the philosophy and the limits of science. Science deals with things that, you know, can be objectified in some way, right?
Right.
You can't deal with some kind of vague concept that can in no way be inferred or measured or dealt with or observed, you know, in any kind of scientific way. It's got to plug into empiricism somehow.
Right.
If it's completely outside the realm of anything that could be measured or whatever or observed or be part of any kind of data, well, then it may or may not exist, but it doesn't exist to science. It's not useful scientifically. It's like having a non-falsifiable hypothesis. Who cares? It's not wrong. It's not even wrong. it's not useful to science. Right.
Right. And there definitely does exist things like that. And I mean, love probably isn't a good example, but I'm sure there are lots of things that you just can't objectify, you can't quantify. And then, yeah, and then science really is agnostic towards that stuff, and that's just the way it is.
Exactly. Well, let's go on with our interview. We're joined now by Elizabeth Loftus. Elizabeth, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to meet you finally. I've been reading your work and reading about you for a long time.
Great.
And you are an expert in human memory.
Yes.
And probably the work for which you are most famous within skeptical circles is your book on repressed memory. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, gee. Well, that sort of came in the middle. I had been doing research on the malleability of memory for years, studying what happens when people see crimes and accidents, and then they get interrogated in suggestive ways, or they get they overhear other witnesses. These activities can distort, contaminate, transform somebody's memory. Then I started to get involved in these cases where there were allegations of repressed memory, and here, in many of these situations, people were coming up with these bizarre and somewhat implausible memories of horrific abuse that they believed had been repressed into mm-hmm. their unconscious until usually psychotherapy made them aware of it. And not only was there no credible scientific support for the idea that memory works like that, it raised the question of where could these so-called memories come from. Mm-hmm. And I believe that many of them were created through the power of suggestion. And so I and my co-author wrote The Myth of Repressed Memory to describe what was going on in society and this whole mm-hmm. issue about memory right. distortion.
So these were dramatic cases, but not cases of repressed memory. They were cases of false memory.
Well, I believe in many of those cases, nothing ever happened.
Yeah. Do you think that there is any reality to the notion of repressed memory? So clearly these cases, I agree, and I think that's the consensus now, these were not cases of a repressed memory of ritual satanic abuse or something when they were younger or some of the more other bizarre things. But do you think that people can push trauma into their subconscious and not consciously remember it for years? Is that something that's – what's the status or the consensus on that right now?
I definitely think that people can have all kinds of experiences, not think about them for a long time, and be reminded of them.
Mm-hmm.
Even some unpleasant experiences you cannot think about for a long time and be reminded of it. There's science to support that. In cognitive psychology, we talk about the power of retrieval cues to remind you of things you haven't thought about. And if you just have to go to a high school reunion and you can experience it for yourself.
Right.
But this all can be explained by ordinary forgetting and remembering. In these repressed memory cases, what's being put forth, what's being proposed, is that something is going on that's too extreme to be explained by ordinary forgetting and remembering. And they call it repression, or sometimes they call it something else, dissociation, traumatic amnesia, whatever you call it. I think we have to ask, what's the evidence for it? And when you look at the kind of evidence that people have put forth that they've tried to fob off on the public and on the court system, mm-hmm. it's not evidence of massive repression.
Mm-hmm. So there's nothing neurological in addition to ordinary forgetting and remembering going on that has been uncovered by scientific research?
In my opinion, yes.
Would you say that that's also the consensus opinion among scientists in your field?
I would say that's a strong consensus opinion, but you still probably have some, we don't know how many, have gone underground now, psychotherapists mm-hmm. who believe in repression and are engaging in activities that are, I believe, harmful to the patients and harmful to the people that they end up accusing.
Could normal forgetting explain some of these traumatic events? Because it seemed to me that, you know, forgetting certain things from your high school friends from 20 years ago, yeah, you could forget that easily. But a traumatic episodes that occurred during your childhood, seemed to me that it'd be hard to forget a lot of that stuff. And so normal forgetting and remembering just can't account for that in most cases. Does that seem reasonable?
Well, I do think that there are some real cases where people, they may read about a priest being accused as a molester and be reminded that they had an unpleasant, fondling experience with that same priest. I would call that ordinary forgetting right. and remembering, not repression or dissociation or anything like that. And maybe you can find some genuine corroboration mm-hmm. for those recently remembered experiences.
That's always the rub, though, right? Is there some external corroboration? Right.
Well, yes. I mean, that's the only way you're going to be able yeah. to reliably know that something is real or to prove that it's not real.
Yeah. Is there, and I think what Bob was getting at, is there a limit, though, to the severity of the trauma where it becomes implausible that somebody would have forgotten it? Like you said, maybe they forgot an unpleasant fondling experience, but can somebody just ordinarily forget, say, a traumatic rape experience? Is there things that are too traumatic for it to be plausible that they could have just been ordinarily forgotten?
Or a series of events.
Is there a number years? Of, yeah, like it's a long-standing thing rather than a single event.
Well, I just say, give me any kind of proof. Sometimes I go into these court cases where people are being accused, and these repression aficionados will come up and they say, I've got 70 studies here that prove repression. And she doesn't know what she's talking about. But when you look at each and every one of those 70 studies, they're not proof.
Mm-hmm.
The best one they have, the best one they have is a study by Linda Meyer Williams, where there were young people who showed up at a hospital or a police station or whatever claiming some abuse. They were ages 0 to 12 years old or 8 months to 12 years old. And 20 years later, when these people were interviewed about their experiences, 38% of them didn't mention the incident.
Mm-hmm.
Just didn't mention it. Well, the repression aficionados want to say that's proof they repressed it. But hey, it's not proof of that at all.
Right.
I mean, one was 8 months old.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them were under the age of 3. And they may not have remembered anything that happened
right.
to them later as adults. And many of the older ones who might have been older, maybe they just didn't want to tell the interviewer 20
right.
years later. They weren't asked directly about it. They
mm-hmm.
just didn't mention it. So if that's the best study you have to support the idea of massive repression that's being used in the prosecution of other people, I say it's not good enough.
Yeah, it's spectral evidence. I mean, I think repressed memory evidence in courtroom.
Right, spectral evidence, and that is the name of one of the finest books that's been written
right.
on this subject
right.
about the Ramona case, if you've
right, right.
Had a chance to read that great book.
But it does bring up what I think is more interesting, and that is we can implant fake memories into people that they can't distinguish from real memories, right? That's what's really interesting about all of this.
I think so, too. And when I look over this sea of tragedies that's been left in the wake of the whole memory wars, all these destroyed families, I say, well, the one benefit or a benefit that's come out of this all is now a new body of research on how relatively easy it is to plant these very rich false memories. We'll have that scientific work there for forever.
Mm-hmm. And go even beyond just getting into the clutches of an incompetent and unethical, in my opinion, therapist who is implanting false memories under the guise of retrieving them. Can you give us some examples of where implanting false memories might occur innocently just in our everyday lives?
Whenever you experience something and later on are exposed to another person's version of it, or asked suggestive and leading questions about it, or maybe you witnessed something that was a high publicity event, and then you open up a newspaper or watch some television or radio, whatever, and hear other witnesses talk or other people describing the event. All of these situations provide the opportunity for new information to enter our awareness and to distort or contaminate our memory.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to continually be vigilant about that.
Yeah, so
how can you be vigilant about that? How do you deal with something like that? Can you say if you have a memory you really want, you don't want to forget, something special happens to you, I guess it would be helpful write it down. Here's my memory of it, and that way you can go back to it years later and say, all right, this is pretty much what happened, and you could be pretty certain that that's not contaminated because it was fresh when you wrote it down.
Yes, and that exactly. Some banks, for example, they're at high risk for robbery and so on, and they're trained, you know, if it ever happens, what to do. And some of them are training their tellers to, before the police show up, before you start talking to other people from the bank, you write down everything you can remember. That rehearsal, not only does it occur a short time after the experience, so the memory's the freshest, but it does protect to some extent. It protects you from further and later contamination.
Sort of locks the memory in place.
Right. And, a rehearsed memory is less vulnerable mm-hmm. to – not completely invulnerable, but less vulnerable to further contamination.
It's funny. I think people would be surprised if they wrote down a memory year, and then years later, mm-hmm. after having talked about it and maybe even read about events surrounding it, then compared their current memory with what they wrote. I think they would be incredibly surprised. Like, what?
Oh, well, in fact, researchers have done exactly that.
Yeah.
In there's a body of work called the work on flashbulb memories.
Right.
So there you have these public events that are very significant.
JFK assassination.
The assassination of JFK is one of the prime ones. If you were over the age of eight or so at mm-hmm. the time, there's a very good chance you have some memory of where you were when you heard the news.
Challenger shuttle, we can use a more recent.
The Challenger shuttle, and now people are using 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
But researchers have gone in there and had people write down what happened shortly after the event, and then mm-hmm. they come back and interview them a couple years
That's
later.
Right.
And there have been a whole series of studies that do this, and there are all kinds of distortions that occur. With the Challenger shuttle, for example, people wrote down, oh, I learned it from a roommate who came in and said, guess what just happened? And 2 years later or so, they're writing down, I first learned it from television. There is that television bias. But
mm-hmm.
but so that study mm-hmm. has been done now a number of times, and people are surprised.
It's a little disturbing. I mean, I have lots of memories mm-hmm. in my head about things that happened to me in the past, and it's strange to think that they could be completely inaccurate.
I know.
So, we say that a lot to each other, right? Yeah. Are you sure that's not distorted?
It does make us feel a little uncomfortable to think that our minds might be full of these bits of fiction. But
it's good to be aware of it, though. It's important to be aware of that.
Well, it's good to be aware of it. And also, I mean, there's some pieces of fiction in there that probably allow us to feel better about ourselves mm-hmm. and live a happier life.
What do you think about the industry of brain training devices and games and whatnot? I've been following that research myself, and it seems like, if I would summarize my understanding of it, I'm always interested in what other people think, is that most of the brain training exercises make you better at that task, but not necessarily for anything beyond that task. What would you say?
Well, that's the issue of generalizability.
Yeah.
And I suppose you can learn how to be good at a particular thing. I'm not sure. I mean, I just have to
study. It doesn't make you smarter in general.
No, so I don't think it's like a it's like a muscle.
Yeah. But with memory, if you train your memory becomes better.
You can learn how to do certain things if you want to remember. So, for example, I know what I need to do if I want to maximize the chances that I will remember the names of people that I meet at a cocktail party.
Yeah.
I know, for example, we've known for years that I don't want to just say Johnny Smith, Johnny Smith, Johnny Smith. You want to space out the practice. But what kind of spacing?
Mm-hmm.
Do I do it every 5 minutes? I say Johnny Smith. It turns out that an expanding pattern of practice where maybe I wait a minute, it's Johnny Smith. Then I wait 5 minutes, Johnny Smith. Then I wait a half hour, Johnny Smith. That expanding pattern maximizes the chances mm-hmm. that I will be able to remember that name when I need to and want to later. Problem is, it's so much work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so much work. It's almost much easier to develop other ways of interacting with people socially.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen you in so long, but you look so much younger.
Yeah.
That's why we have name tags at these conferences.
Yes.
We don't have to worry about things
right.
like that.
Right, right, right. But I'm interested in that. I mean, partly because it's such an industry, you know, that built up around it, but it seems like it's an industry built on sort of false science and false hopes.
Well, no. I mean, you can learn these tricks.
Yeah, right.
You can learn
tricks. Yeah, I'm not talking about the techniques. Yeah. There are techniques, as you just were saying, that will help you. But the specific claim that you can make your kids smarter people or you can make yourself smarter in general, again, just generalizing. And they do try to make it sound like it's like not a learned skill, but it's actually improving the function of your brain. I guess that's what I'm getting at. And I haven't seen the evidence to conclude that that's the case.
Right. I don't know that there is the evidence. And then, I gather there's some litigation arising out of the skeptic challenges to baby Einstein and
Mozart effect.
I don't think there's any evidence for the Mozart effect.
Talked about that.
Yeah, that's already crashed and burned, the Mozart effect. What are you working on now?
Well, right now, I have a collaboration with some Chinese researchers, so they have a lot of money and a lot of support for scientific work. So we've been doing one of the largest scaled studies of memory distortion with Chinese subjects. We're just publishing a paper on whether or not and how long these false memories last. I'm interested in once you plant a false memory, does it have repercussions for people? Do they last? Do they last as long as their true memories do? Mm-hmm. Then we're trying to learn more about individual differences. Who is susceptible to having their memories be contaminated, and who resists? And
how about this question? I've only seen a little things on this. Can you distinguish a false memory from a true memory? I think the one thing I read was that the number of details may be a distinguishing feature.
Well, the big problem is, yes, if you take a group of true memories and a group of false memories, you can sometimes find statistically differences, more sensory detail with the true than the false, maybe even some little statistical differences using neuroimaging in brain signals with true versus false. But the big problem is that these differences are too slight to be useful for what the court system needs and wants, taking a single memory and then classifying it reliably as accurate or not.
It's an important distinction. So it doesn't help you evaluate a single memory. It's just a statistical description of the classes of memories.
Right. And you need lots of trues and lots of falses to be able to see that little difference.
Well, Elizabeth Loftus, thank you very much. This has been a fascinating interview.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items, four facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I see how many of my skeptics can tell me which one is the fake. Bob and Rebecca have been doing pretty well, trading back and forth in the last couple of months.
Yeah.
Jane, Evan, not so much.
Meh.
We'll see how you can do this week.
All right.
All right, here we go. Item number one. Physicists have developed a method for testing whether or not our universe exists as part of a greater multiverse and have even conducted preliminary, although inconclusive, observations. Item number two, new research indicates that those who live to be 95 or older have lifestyles that are no healthier than the general population. And item number three, biologists have discovered a plant that attracts pollinating bats by producing ultrasound that mimics the bat's echolocation. All right, Evan, go first.
Physicists have developed a method for testing whether or not our universe exists as part of a greater multiverse. I mean, I understand the very general concept of universe versus multiverse and these little bubble universes that exist out there. So have they conducted preliminary observations? That's the real question here, the main part of this. I don't know if that's right. The second one about the new research indicating those who live to be 95 or older have lifestyles no healthier than the general population. I'm going to figure that one is true. If you're 95 today, you were growing up in the through the 1920s. Certainly we knew things about nutrition and so forth, but I mean, lifestyles and these sorts of things, it was still a very rural lifestyle way back when. So I tend to think that one's correct. The last one, biologists discovering a plant that attracts pollinating bats by producing ultrasound that mimics the bat's echolocation. Steve tracks pollinating bats, so the bats are pollinating?
Yeah, bats are key for lots of
pollination, but
whole economies.
They're contributing to the pollination process. They themselves are not pollinating. Or is that how you say it? That if you're a contributor to a pollinating process, you're pollinating.
Yeah, you're a pollinator.
Pollinator.
You're a pollinator.
Right, because I thought, you know,
pollinate
the act of pollinating would be the act of producing pollen.
No.
No.
Okay.
No.
Just like bees pollinate, bats do the same. They go from plant to plant and...
So we're talking about the verb as opposed to the noun.
Yeah, it's pollinating.
Pollen.
Yeah, you're not manufacturing pollen, moving it from.
But
one
you understand my point, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's wrong.
Yeah, your point is that you don't know the meaning of the word pollinating.
Let's move on,
guys. Let him hang himself. Come on.
All right, go ahead. Yeah.
enough stalling. I don't know. It's between that and the multiverse. Have they made observations about the multiverse, or have they made up a phony thing to trick bats into pollinating things? It would seem more plausible that they've come up with a means of mimicking the bat echolocation. No, be that as it may, I think that that's. I'm going to say that that one's the fiction, though, because the one about the multiverse, Steve. I think yes, they've conducted perhaps some preliminary observations and so forth, but although inconclusive, I think is the key there, and you can do a lot of work and not come to any sort of real firm conclusion. So that actually becomes less surprising. I'll say the bats. That one's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
The one about the physicists who've developed a method for testing whether or not the universe exists as part of a greater multiverse. All my instincts are telling me that this one is complete BS. I mean, how are we going to possibly see outside the bounds of the universe to test anything? I just don't see any way, shape, or form, under any circumstance, anything that we could possibly imagine that would allow us to test that. So right out of the gate, I'm picking that one as the fake, but I want to talk about the other two as well. I totally agree with the second item about people that live past 95 don't necessarily have the most healthy lifestyles. That's totally genetic. Duh. And the one about the bats, I don't know. What is it? Some plant is attracting bats, so they pollinate themselves, like the bats will pollinate them. Now they're producing echolocation. It says ultrasound that mimics the bat's echolocation. Bats by producing ultrasound that mimics. So it just makes me think that maybe the plant, when the wind is blowing through it, it resonates a certain frequency. That's the frequency of the bat, or maybe, you know, just it moving in for any reason. Something like that, maybe. I don't know. How could a plant produce sound like that, like a high-pitched squeal? How could they possibly... I'm not saying it's impossible, because I definitely would never put it past some freaky thing going on with a plant or an insect or something crazy. But I don't know. I can't think of how it's done, but I think it's definitely possible that there is some type of way it evolved to do something along those lines. I just can't figure it out. So anyway, number one, anyone who doesn't go for that is crazy. It's the first one that's the fake. Duh. Duh, Steve. Duh.
Jay just called me crazy.
All right, Rebecca.
That's
abuse. I'm crazy too, I guess, because this item reminds me of one we had a while back that was about how physicists were peering into our past to see what happened before the Big Bang. I think we all had a similar sort of how sort of response to that. But physicists be crazy. I can see them figuring out a way to do this. With math, all things are possible.
No. Nope.
So I think it's possible. I agree with Jay about the old people one, people who live to be 95 or older. I think it's genetic. So that makes perfect sense to me, which leaves me with bats and plants that produce ultrasound. It's not out of the question for a plant to produce sound. That happens, you know, even like Venus flytraps and things can produce small amounts of sound. But I think it's more likely.
Yeah, right. What do they say, Rebecca?
I think
land here, please. Come. Land here.
Are you done? Okay.
What about the screaming watermelon? Remember the screaming watermelon?
Yes.
I think it's more likely that a plant would evolve certain ways to take advantage of bats' echolocation, but not by producing sound. So I think that that one's false.
Okay, Bob.
All right, the first one about the multiverse.
Bob, come on.
Bob.
give him a chance.
I think most of the reason why I think that is because of what Bob has drilled into me over the years. And Bob, right. Really? Come on.
Well, let me talk. Jay, I agree that discovering or detecting something outside the our universe is probably impossible. But Jay, I disagree with your premise. They don't necessarily need to detect something outside the universe. They could potentially detect another universe that somehow interacted with our universe. A much more higher probability.
Bob, we're in an enclosed system.
But if the multiverses interact somehow, so perhaps they could possibly look at that interaction, perhaps looking at the cosmic microwave background radiation or something.
Okay,
sort of
so which would mean that there has to be some type of energy exchange, which there isn't. Bob!
I'm just saying, Jay, it sounds more plausible than you
plausible?
Might think.
Plausible? Oh, my God.
If you've got these other multiverses, they could potentially interact somehow with the cosmic microwave background radiation, perhaps. So there could be some sort of interaction. So, yeah, detecting a universe outside of ours, no. But interacting with ours,
I can barely find my way to the post office, and you're telling me that we're detecting the multiverses?
You're not a physicist, Jay.
Right, Jay.
through the interaction, that's possible. So the second one, though, this one is pretty much a no-brainer for me. I mean, one of the things you learn about fitness and good lifestyles is that you're not going to increase your lifespan tremendously. You could potentially live a lot longer if you can avoid a heart attack at 60. Yeah, you can live to be 80 or 85 or whatever, but it's not going to necessarily make you live to be 95 or 105
older. Regular colonoscopy after the age of 50, you extend your life expectancy by 1 year.
That's a good plug.
How regular are these colonoscopies?
Yeah, once every 10 years.
Yeah.
And I'll enjoy them.
We know, Jay. We know.
So those aren't colonoscopies, Jay. That's something else.
So the point is that a healthy lifestyle will give you greater quality of life, which is the big benefit, not necessarily make you live to the incredibly ripe old ages of 95 or older. So that makes perfect sense. Yes, it is genetic. And the third one, this one does not make much sense to me at all. The wind creating it somehow by interacting with the plants. I mean, that would have to be one hell of a wind and one hell of a stiff plant to produce ultrasound. I can't think of a way that plants would evolve or produce or have that effect. And I'm not even sure bats would like ultrasound producing plants. They would be like, what the hell is that? I'm going to stay away from it.
Come here, come.
it's going to be saying, oh, there's another bat over there. I think I'll stay away from it, unless it sounds like a sexy ultrasound. I don't think so. That one makes the least sense to me, so I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, so you all agree that new research indicates that those who live to be 95 or older have lifestyles that are no healthier than the general population. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Oh, of course.
Yep, that was the easy one this week.
Of course.
And you guys all got it right because that's the big question, right? Is it lifestyle or genetics? And this recent study suggests that it's genetics. What they did was they looked at 477 people aged 95 to 112, and they asked them about their lifestyle habits when they were 70 because they figured that would be representative of their lifestyle as an adult, not so much what they're doing at 100. For example, regular exercise, smoking, what they're eating, etc. And then they compared that to data from other studies, comparing it to several thousand controls, just the general population. And they essentially found no significant difference. So no difference in lifestyle accounting for their longevity. So it is down to genetics, just if you get good genes. If you want to live a long time, get good genes. That's the advice. You choose your grandparents wisely. So let's go on to number one. We'll go to number one. You can't, Bob doesn't correlate with which one's the science or the fiction.
I know. I'm well aware of that.
Physicists have developed a method for testing whether or not our universe exists as part of a greater multiverse and have even conducted preliminary, although inconclusive, observations. Jay is very adamant that this one cannot possibly be science. The rest of you think that this one is science. And
Steve,
this
I'm the only one.
Sorry.
You're the only one, Jay.
I will go as far as saying that I know I'm right and you're all wrong. I'm celebrating right now. I don't even have to.
You looked it up, right?
Yeah. No, okay. I didn't look it up. It's obvious.
And this one is science. Jay.
No, it's not.
I recall you called me crazy, too, in that whole conversation.
Oh, boy.
Bob, did you read this one? Because you basically nailed it.
No, it just made sense.
Yeah. So,
sweet.
Sweet. It is kind of sweet when you think about it.
So this is published in Physical Review Letters and Physical Review D, the first inkling of how we might make an observation that could let us infer whether or not we are an isolated universe or a bubble universe existing in a multiverse of many universes. And Bob, you essentially got it exactly right. What they're looking for are the effects on the cosmic background radiation of our neighbor universes bumping into our universe. If you imagine a bunch of like soap bubbles pushing up against each other, they distort it a little bit. So what they're looking for are ringed distortions in the cosmic background radiation. And they think that, you know, that this would, if they find these, this would be evidence for a multiverse. They did look at make some preliminary observations of the cosmic background radiation. The results, they said, were inconclusive. The article is actually very interesting. The article says, and I wonder if this is in reaction to other physicists who have gone in this direction. The article says that one of many dilemmas facing physicists is that humans are very good at cherry-picking patterns in the data that may just be coincidence. Right, that's exactly right.
Oh, yeah.
However, the team's algorithm is much harder to fool, so they're imposing a very strict algorithm on the data.
Cool.
And, you know, basically saying ahead of time, these are the criteria. This is, you know, the computer's going to be making the calculations, and if it fits the criteria, we'll call it positive, rather than just, you know, looking and seeing if we see a pattern that could fit our predictions. Because that lends to, you know, data mining and pattern recognition, et cetera. So, but they are waiting for some new data, some more detailed data on the cosmic background radiation, and they're looking at the European Space Agency's Planck satellite, and they think that the data from that satellite will help resolve at least this particular prediction.
Oh man, cool. How awesome would that be?
Very awesome.
Please let it be true.
Jay, you okay over there?
I hate the fact that my brain is rejecting this, because I would think it's more likely that they're making mathematical errors than they're detecting the universes outside of our universe.
Well, they haven't detected it yet. I mean, it's mainly the theory. If a neighboring universe bumps up against our universe, would it leave an impact on the cosmic background radiation? That's the premise that they're going at. If that premise is wrong, then but of course what they're saying is, if their premise is correct, they will see these ringed patterns in the cosmic background radiation. If their premise is wrong, they won't be there. Or if they're not there, either their premise is wrong or there's only one universe. If they're there though, then at least it matches their prediction. Then you'll have to decide, is there other things that could produce the same patterns?
Right.
Yeah. My theory is they're wrong.
Okay.
Well, it's a good theory, Jay.
It's very speculative, obviously. But
so is my theory. That's fine, but I at least can live with mine.
Number three, biologists have discovered a plant that attracts pollinating bats by producing ultrasound that mimics the bat's echolocation is fiction. Yeah, but have any of you read the article this is based on?
Yes.
Was that the plant, the mammal and the plant poison thing that you
No.
One from? No.
Okay. No, let me read you the headline, and you'll know why I use this one. Plant evolved a bat beckoning beacon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. If you just read that, you might have gotten confused by this one. But, yeah, Rebecca obviously read the whole article. What the plants evolved to do is to have specially shaped leaves that reflect the echolocation, the sounds, the ultrasound of the bat, so that they can find it easier. And what the scientists discovered is that when the leaves are in place, the bats are twice as likely to find the plant than when the leaves are not in place.
Oh, cool. So it's more likely. It's shooting it back at them?
Yeah. It's like a little radar dish, sonar dish, you know, reflecting the echolocation back at the bats. Oh, that's
awesome. Here I am. Here I am.
Yeah.
Sweet.
And it works. It works. Right. Yeah.
Looking into a mirror.
Yes, this was out there a little bit in terms of the fiction, but I was thinking, you know, there's so many small or animals or whatnot that can produce incredibly loud noises by exploiting some acoustic property. Like crickets are tiny little insects, but they dig themselves into a little hole that becomes like a reflecting dish for the sound. That's why they sound so loud. And the animal that makes the loudest noise of any animal in the world is this little shrimp.
Shrimp.
Screaming shrimp.
Clicks its claws together, but it clicks. Creates a claws little sonic boom like in its claws. I think that's how it does it. It's like this it's like a little bubble of sound that gets trapped in its claw. And it creates this really loud noise.
And so do you know what makes the quietest noise?
What's that, Jay?
One hand clapping.
It's the Venus flytrap. He's just going, come here.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that shrimp actually uses its sound to stun its prey.
Yeah, that's how loud it is.
That's how loud
it is. It's the pistol shrimp.
Yeah. And cicadas, use like a rib cage type of thing to expand and contract, and it like makes a noise each time it goes. Yeah, and they're some of the loudest insects in the world.
218 decibels. The pistol
shrimp.
That's wow.
So good work, everyone. Jay, you know, this one threw a little curveball at you. It was a tough one.
It was a curveball the size of the universe. Anyway,
multiverse.
I still think I'm right.
Get it right.
All right. Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I have a quote that is completely not skeptical, but totally apropos for the first news item that we did tonight.
Okay.
And the quote is, and I can't say it like the guy that says it, and you'll understand when you hear it, but I have something to say. It's better to burn out than to fade away.
Ah, nice, Jay. Better to burn out than fade away.
You know who that is, Steve?
Oh, Def Leppard guy.
The Kurgan?
Of course.
The Kurgan, man. Come
on. There can only be one.
You know, he borrowed that from the Def Leppard song, Rock of Ages.
Yeah. Who are you talking about?
The Kurgan.
Kurgan from Highlander.
Highlander.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
We have one announcement this week. The CSI conference is coming up.
CSICON.
CSICON. October 27th through 30th. In New Orleans. You can register at sciconference.org.
It's going to be awesome.
It's going to be awesome. Yeah. You know, so CSI has, I don't think they've done a really big skeptical conference in a while. They don't do it every year, but they usually do a very good job. Looking at the lineup, I see some familiar faces. I see one Rebecca Watson. I see your picture there.
That's correct.
I will also be speaking at the conference.
I believe you are getting a special prize, are you not, Steve?
They're giving me a prize, yes, mm-hmm. for my skepticalness over the past
good.
Year.
Bowl not bad, with Steve. A hat.
That's good work, boys.
Cool. Yep. Bill Nye, Eugenie Scott, Phil Plate, James Randi. Lawrence Krauss. A lot of speakers.
So yeah, and they're having a Mardi Gras parade. So like, it's like Mardi Gras, but Smarty. And then it ends with like a big costume party because it's
Halloween.
Your
brains.
It's going to be awesome.
I hope it is.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Good night, Steve.
Yeah.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Come here. Come.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcasts, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.